Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 222. Wise Mind, Open Mind, with Ron Alexander. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
And in Buddhist psychology, the emphasis is it's not just on what's called wholesome experience, like, for example, pursuing joy, bliss, states of ecstasy, states of numinosity and oneness. But Buddhist psychology says all experience can be divided between wholesome, positive, neutral experience, and negative, painful, afflictive, or unwholesome experience. And in this continuum, in Buddhist psychology, there's an emphasis that what you want to do is like a gardener who's weeding weeds from his garden or collecting the manure from his cows. You want to till it all into the soil so that next year you're the farmer or the gardener who has the best crop or the greenest grass because you've embraced and you've incorporated your own manure, which is your shadow experiences. You've looked more deeply at your own tendencies to have emotions that, if not mindfully worked with, can cause you a lot of pain and a lot of suffering.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Ronald A. Alexander. Ronald A. Alexander, Ph.D., is author of the 2009 book, Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis, Loss, and Change. Dr. Alexander practices mind-body psychotherapy and leadership coaching in Santa Monica, California, and he specializes in the practice of somatic psychology, creative and leadership training. He teaches clinical training groups for professionals in somatic psychotherapy and Ericksonian mind-body healing therapies and the art of mindfulness meditation. He leads workshops at growth centers throughout the U.S. and abroad. He was also a guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 29 back in 2006 when I interviewed him on mindful leadership, mindful living. Many years ago, he was one of my master's students at Sonoma State University, and now I regard him as both colleague and teacher. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ronald Alexander, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's a delight to be back, David.
Yeah. Well, now you and I are longtime friends, so I'm going to drop the Dr. Ronald Alexander and call you Ron, okay?
That's fine, David.
Yep. And I am welcoming you back because I did a podcast with you. Oh, boy, it's been a couple of years ago at least. It was one of the early podcasts. I should have looked this up ahead of time, but I think it was either number 29 or number 30.
Yeah, it was very early on in your development.
Right. And in fact, right now, you're on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, and I'm in Northern California, and I was going to be joining you there on Kauai, but my plans changed, and so I'm not making it this time.
No, maybe we'll have a road trip to Europe in the next year.
That would be great. I'll look forward to that. Well, I wanted to focus today on your new book, Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis, Loss, and Change. I received an advanced copy, and friendship aside, I have to say I'm really impressed.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. It means a lot to me.
Now, this book has been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Probably about 30, 34 years coming.
Yeah, right. It really embodies the past 30 years of your work. Now, your book has a very strong focus on mindfulness meditation, and it seems like mindfulness meditation has really emerged as perhaps the leading approach in this country, with lots of research studies on mindfulness and a variety of psychotherapies that incorporate mindfulness in one way or another. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think mindfulness has become mainstream and has really caught fire in both academic and research settings. For example, you have Richard Davison, Dr. Richard Davison at the University of...
Wisconsin, I think.
Yes. He has his own brain mind research lab doing PET scans and CAT scan studies. And you have other researchers all around the country. And so I think science has come onto the subject of mindfulness, as well as the psychotherapeutic community. And I think some of that is a result of the Dalai Lama's public teachings, as well as his private meetings with the Mind Life Institute, where a group of physicians, neuroscience, brain researchers, noted psychologists in the transpersonal psychology movement, cognitive behavioral psychologists, neuroscientists and psychiatrists like Dr. Daniel Siegel from UCLA and the Mindfulness Awareness Research Center. And they've been meeting over about the last 14 years. And one of their topics has been how to apply mindfulness to the field at large of mental health, behavioral, holistic and integrated medicine, as well as psychotherapy. And I think with the Dalai Lama really being the locomotive that has been pulling this train, a lot of people have gotten on board. And he's been encouraging for at least the last 15 years for there to be more active research into, does mindfulness affect changes not only in one's consciousness, in one's awareness, but does it also make changes in the brain? And that's one of the most significant things that we've recently come to discover.
Well, you know, I think you're right. I hadn't connected it to the Dalai Lama and his growing importance and the public awareness of his work, but I think you're right about that. And you mentioned Dr. Richard Davidson, and actually we've sort of had to reschedule an interview with him a couple of times, and right now I think he's scheduled for November, so that's an interview I'm really looking forward to. Now, you've explored a number of spiritual traditions and practices over the years. How did you find your way to the mindfulness approach?
It's a great question. When I did my first 2 years of college in Boston, I was still living close to home and all of my friends from high school, and I grew up in an Irish Catholic family of 10 kids, so closely well-knit family. And in my junior year, I transferred to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst because they had a five-college program called the Bachelor's Degree in Individual Concentration. And part of what attracted me to decide between going to the University of New Hampshire, which I think you were a professor, a visiting guest, distinguished professor at for a few years, weren't you?
Yes, that's right. Good memory.
I had a scholarship there and a scholarship to UMass Amherst. And what attracted me to go to Amherst was the five-college program, which gave me the opportunity to minor in Buddhist studies at Smith College and at the same time study consciousness studies in the field of altered states at a very small creative college called Hampshire College. And so while I was there, we had a kind of an ongoing correspondence and co-visitation. I invited Dan Goleman, the noted author today of emotional intelligence, to actually give his very first public talk in his entire life, which was at the University of Massachusetts. He gave a talk on the Tibetan Wheel of the Life, Birth, and Death. And him and Richard Davison were working at Harvard in the School of Social Relationships, and they were doing a research study on meditation and altered states of consciousness. And myself and Alan Como, who you may remember.
I do.
We were doing a research study at the Menninger Clinic and the Veterans Administration Hospital at Topeka, Kansas. And at that time, I was involved in the study of Kundalini yoga and Kundalini meditation.
Right, I remember that.
And we actually brought some of that to Sonoma State University, where we came out to study with you and Eleanor Criswell and Stanley Krippner. As a result of that, I got extremely interested in Dan Goleman's research on Buddhist meditation and actually found that that was more compatible to me. It kind of, there was more of a sense of an attunement to Buddhist meditation than actually to the yoga by itself. And then shortly after being there for a year, my grade point average was about 3.85. And around midterm time of senior year, I started having panic attacks because I had all this pressure about getting into graduate school. And I didn't even know what anxiety was at that point in my life, let alone what a panic attack was. And so a young doctor, I went to the student mental health services, and a young doctor named Kent Hulley was referred to me to be my therapist. And in the first 10 or 15 minutes of us talking, he described to me that he had taken the last year off on sabbatical, and he had spent almost the entire time in India studying meditation, Buddhist forms of meditation, various forms of yogic practices. And he said something that is really seminal, which is probably the cornerstone to why I have devoted so much of my life to being involved in mindfulness meditation and Buddhist studies. And that was, he said, well, I could give you medication or I could teach you meditation. Which of the two would you are you most interested in? Medication or meditation? And medication kind of frightened me. I didn't really know much about that. So I said, I think I'll take the second choice on the menu.
So he gave me a prescription to come for the next 6 weeks and that we were going to do meditation practice from the Buddhist perspective, which he had recently learned in his trip in India, which he had studied and taken a series of courses on mindfulness meditation. And so I began to practice mindfulness, and he suggested that I do it twice a day. And usually I recommend 20 minutes twice a day, but he suggested that I actually sit for 45 minutes and, if possible, longer. And so I had so much anxiety back in those days that I remember sitting sometimes for 2 hours at a time in the morning and 2 hours at a time in the evening.
Wow.
And then he mentioned to me about in our sixth visit, that a very well-known Franciscan monk was going to come and to teach a course at the Spencer Abbey, which was a Trappist monastery a couple of hours outside of Amherst, on Buddhist meditation and Christian contemplative meditation. So, of course, that really sounded exciting, and so I headed off and spent the week in silence at this Trappist monastery. And having been raised Catholic, I was very used to and drawn to the Gregorian chanting and Vespers and the Mass once a day. And during the day, we were instructed to meditate an hour on, and then an hour off, we were to go out into the fields and to work. But the work and all the eating was in silence. And so this was a way of developing over a course of a week a very strong and steady mindfulness practice, kind of mindfulness both on the cushion as well as mindfulness in each of our daily actions, brushing our teeth, combing our hair, cutting our food, chewing our food, painting a fence, building a rock wall.
That's a really fascinating background. And then later on, you actually got ordained as a Zen monk, isn't that right?
Yeah, in 1999, one of the senior teachers from the San Francisco Zen Center, who is a Zen priest and also has Dharma transmission, who is a follower of Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center in Tassajara in the Green Gulch Farm. Zen priest name and Dharma holder is Ed Brown. He's also the well-known author of all the cookbooks, the Tassajara cookbooks.
Oh.
So I spent a number of summers studying with Ed at Tassajara, and then in 1999, after probably about 30 years of seriously thinking about did I want to take the vows, there are seven vows, I chose to take five of the seven. That's the good thing about Zen. You don't have to take them all.
That's great.
So you can ward off disappointment and any guilt that you may experience in case you go all over the wall and break any of your vows. So I chose to take the five that I thought I could fulfill. I did that in 1999.
Okay. Well, let's focus on your book. You've got a chapter on the basics of mindfulness meditation. Take us through that. How does a person get started?
Well, the very first thing to do is to understand that there's probably three or four basic points of attention in any kind of mindfulness practice. And the first point of attention is to link attention with intention. And the intention that one needs to have when they're practicing or developing a mindfulness practice is the intention to develop concentration. And for all of us, even after 35 years of practicing, we all really suffer with what's called monkey mind. And monkey mind is a simple way of saying that the mind has a lot of chatter. The small self or the small mind in Zen, we say, is constantly talking. It's constantly creating hindrances and distractions to being able to sit, relax, rest freely, and at a more advanced level to drop into what's called wise mind. And I write a lot about it in my book. So the first point of attention is to focus intention with attention. The second point of a mindfulness practice is, well, what do you do in order to do that? What you do is you need to have a breath practice. And in order to have a breath practice, it means that you need to begin to start focusing one's awareness on whether you're breathing in on the in-breath or out on the out-breath and mentally repeating that. Or another style of that that some people find much more conducive is to say rising, so that as you breathe in, your lungs fill with air and oxygen, and then when you breathe out, you say falling away. So rising on the in-breath, falling away on the out-breath. So breath practice is the second point of attention, and it's really essential if you're going to build concentration over time in a mindfulness practice that you have a breath practice.
Okay, those are the first two points of concentration, and I think you said there are four. What are the next two?
The third point of attention is what is called a mudra, and that's what you do with your hands. And the easiest thing to do, there's probably 1,008 different mudras to use in any kind of meditation practice, but the most simple and basic one is to take your thumb and your very first finger and lightly touch them, and then place them together with your palms facing upward on your left thigh and on your right thigh. And then the next point of attention is to sit up straight and slightly turn your chin forward and looking down, and it's the point of attention for one's eyes. And it's best when we're practicing mindfulness to usually close your eyes and focus on either the tip of your nostrils or the space between your eyebrows, which is oftentimes referred to in the yogic literature as the third eye or the mind's eye. And then the last point of attention, which one would say would be number four or number five, is, well, what do you do now that you have all these points of attention in place? So while you're breathing in and you're breathing out and you're saying in and out or rising and falling, and you have your eyes focused at either the tip of your nostrils or at your third eye and your thumb and first finger together in a mudra, in order to develop concentration, you have to do something with the mind. And the last point of attention is called the development of the witness, and what we call refer to as the witnessing awareness. And that's something that you do by training the mind to note and to take notice, and as Suzuki Roshi, the great Zen teacher, taught, to learn about the self, you have to study the self. And to know the self is to look more deeply into the self. So the last point of attention really is that we cultivate a witnessing mind, a witnessing awareness that begins to observe, note, comment, and then let go of everything that it's noting, everything that it's observing, everything that it's commenting on, and to simply be still. And that's a tall order.
Yes, it is, in my experience. And you also earlier suggested 2 20-minute sessions a day. And I think for many people, that might seem like a tall order.
I do. I agree with you, David. I think my sister, who is in nursing administration in Boston, just bought the book. And she started out and said that she found it was utter agony to get through the first 5 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
She Facebooked me and she said, how can I ever get to 20 minutes or an hour? And I said, just add a minute a day. Get a food timer or get a timer. Use the timer on your iPhone and add a minute a day and just gently push yourself up to the next level of time. But once you arrive at 20 minutes, get comfortable, get easy with it. So that you're actually resting and relaxing in the meditation rather than trying to do a lot of efforting. And then always, if for some people, very highly fast-paced businessmen, business executives, will find that 5 minutes is more than enough of what they need, either at the beginning of a day, at the end of the day, or even in the middle of the day. There's a couple of people that I coach who are executives in Manhattan, and I tell them, well, close your door and tell your assistant you're not going to take any calls for 5 or 15 minutes. And for some people, they're able to do that. And then other people who don't have their own private office, I say, well, go into the stairwell and then just start very slowly climbing the stairs in a mindful meditation. Or climbing down the stairs and then climbing back up the stairs in a mindful meditation. And use that as your coffee break. Use that as a mindfulness break.
Interesting. One of the things that you write about is resistance. And, of course, you're also a psychotherapist, and resistance is a big topic in psychotherapy. And it seems like any time we set off on a self-improvement or change project, resistance crops up. What sorts of resistance do people encounter in this practice, and how do you suggest they deal with them?
Well, that's a terrific question. In Buddhist psychology, the saying is that whatever you run from will chase after you, and whatever you chase will run away from you. And that really is a good way to lead into that. In meditation, there's a series of what we call, and they were articulated first by the Buddha in the very first treatise that in discourse that he gave on Satipatthana. And Satipatthana in Pali means insight and wisdom. And in this discourse, the Buddha talked about that there are a lot of hindrances that emerge in the mind, hindrances of distraction, of ill will, of sluggishness or torpor, of desire, of lusting, of wanting, of being in desirous mind of either wanting something different than what you're experiencing or wanting something more. And in Western psychology, we often say that resistance, whatever you resist, will really continue to persist until you soften the defenses and go and penetrate to a deeper level of affective and emotional experience. And I think that's really carries over to mindfulness, and mindfulness practice really is a very good tool, particularly to help people who have very strong defenses. And in those defenses sometimes have very useful purposes, and other times they have interfering purposes, interfering with not being able to feel your feelings more fluidly or more freely. And so there's a great similarity in what we do with these resistances or these hindrances in both Buddhist meditation practice and Western contemporary psychotherapy. And that's the very first and foremost thing, is where we always want to identify what the resistances are. And second, what are their functions? And then third, what are their structures? And then finally, fourth, in both practices, we want to dismantle the hindrances or resistances so that then the psyche has a more fluid exchange with the body, and the body has a more fluid exchange with the psyche, and then one is able to tap into their creative unconscious as well as into their affective experience. In simple terms, one is able to feel their feelings more fluidly and freely. And the more that we're able to feel our feelings more fluidly and freely, the more vitality, the more passion, the greater sense of well-being we begin to cultivate in everyday life.
I would think some of the resistances that might come up would be, I don't have enough time, my body is uncomfortable, this is boring, this isn't going to work for me.
Right, and those are very well articulated. Just this morning, I woke up and I had an interview on a radio program from Boston, and so they called it 5:30 because it was 11:30 in Boston. They didn't know I was in Hawaii. And then I got a call from a colleague at 7 o'clock, and I was already pre-thinking that you and I were going to be doing this podcast at 10 o'clock. And my mind started to say, well, maybe you'll meditate later in the day because you really need to prepare and sort through a variety of things so that you give the podcast 100% focus. And then I saw that, and I looked at it, and I said, is that a resistance? And I identified it. Yeah, that was a resistance. So then I went and I sat down and I meditated for 21 minutes. And in the first few minutes, what emerged was, oh, I should be doing something more important, like perhaps doing morning pages or writing in my mindfulness journal so that I'm really empty and free by the time I get on the podcast. And I saw that as resistance. And I went through a series of all these distractions that were trying to prevent me from just sitting. And after about 5 minutes, I just dropped into this really kind of calm and spacious and delicious place where I really wasn't thinking about anything. And I think that's the core of mindfulness, which is eventually mindfulness practice, whether you're a beginner or you're an advanced practitioner, will eventually just drop you into that place of a quiet, empty stillness. You may continue to have thoughts, but they will recede to the back of your mind, like kind of subtle talk. But what comes forward into the foreground of your consciousness and awareness is a pervading and all-abiding sense of stillness, equanimity, peacefulness and harmony. And in that state, then I think, as I write in the book, you move from wise mind, which is the state of wise mind, into what I call open mind. And open mind is when you really enter into the opening in your consciousness where you can tap directly your unconscious mind and especially the creative resources that are involved in tapping into your own internal creativity. One of the things that I hear in my private practice, and I hear all around the country and the world, wherever I'm teaching, in all walks of life, all forms of business, is everyone says, how can I become more creative at what I do? Even mothers and fathers, when they'll come in Australia and they're living up in the Gold Coast, say, I really wish I could, I'm a farmer, but I really wish I could feel creative in my life, like gifted painters or musicians or artists. And I tell them that all they have to do is to learn to get quiet and still with themselves, and that inside of everybody, there's this enormous pool of creativity. Now, not everybody's going to become the next Mark Rothko or be a prolific songwriter like Joni Mitchell. But everybody does have inside of themselves that same pool of creativity that needs to be tapped into, that people are thirsting and really searching to tap into. And the road in there is, the key is to guide oneself in mindfully through a mindfulness practice, which is the first door that opens into the room where there's many different rooms in the house of self. And one of those very, very spacious and special rooms is the room of open mind.
I think that's one of the things that really distinguishes your book, is that there are two primary themes that weave throughout it. The one that we've been focusing on is mindfulness meditation, but also there's this second thread of releasing creativity. And I think that's really a unique contribution of your book and your approach.
Yes. Part of what my book is about is helping people to learn mindfulness meditation to enhance their sense of well-being and to calm their thoughts and to work through crisis, pain, and loss. But the second part has much more to do with the emergent new field of positive psychology. And that field is really lighting a fire under all of us clinicians worldwide to begin to start focusing in the same way that when I was a student of yours at Sonoma State University and you first introduced me to the field of humanistic and existential psychology, where the teachings were about Abraham Maslow and to focus on self-actualization, and Sidney Girard, authenticity, is that this field of positive psychology, similar to humanistic existential psychology, is really trying to say, instead of focusing on what isn't working and what is pathologically wrong and not right and trying to go about in the therapeutic or transformational process trying to fix it or change it, the field of positive psychology, and mindfulness is a part of that field, it's almost an emergent new force, I think, is saying, let's focus on people's creativity. Let's focus on what makes people thrive, what brings people's passion and creativity alive inside of them, and to then notice and study how when you help people to focus on what's good and on what's creative and what they're passionate about, how by tapping into those energies, they can both navigate through some of their problems. At times, they'll be able to transform their problems into creative works of art or a more creative and impassioned way of being in the world. And I think this is a wonderful new road that's been opened up.
Well, I agree with you. And it's great to hear that you're as excited about positive psychology as I have been. At first, I was offended, I guess, because the positive psychologists didn't seem to give much credit to humanistic psychology and to people like Maslow and other pioneers in that area, as if none of that had ever happened. And in fact, both sets of people were coming from the same basic impulse, I think. But what the positive psychology movement has brought to it is a much stronger commitment to empirical research and to really exploring these ideas as much as possible using research. And the other thing, though, that I want to mention here is it's interesting that just, you know, I've been interviewing a lot of people and reading a lot of books coming out of the positive psychology movement, and almost every one of them lists mindfulness as, you know, one of the maybe 8 or 12 things that really characterize being on the path towards some kind of, quotes, happiness.
Yeah, and I think it's a mistake that the field of positive psychology doesn't provide more respect and give more credence to the enormous effect that the field of humanistic existential psychology had as a forerunner to positive psychology, especially because mindfulness actually is not the fifth force in psychology, which cognitive behavioral, dialectical behavioral therapy, EMDR, postmodern, the narrative, positive psychology, they articulate themselves and they put mindfulness into that field, which is the fifth field. Just for the listeners, I'll reiterate the chronology. The first force in psychology was Freudian. Sorry. Yeah. Second was behavioral. Third was humanistic existential. And then the fourth was the transpersonal psychological movement, which mindfulness in Buddhist and meditative practices in the study of altered states of consciousness, they grew out of the effect that humanistic existential psychology created in the field. A whole new pathway was opened up. And mindfulness really fits into the fourth field, fourth force of psychology, and the fifth force. So I think the field of positive psychology should bear more witness and more acknowledgement and provide more thanks to the third force, which is the humanistic existential field, which you and myself both came out of.
Yeah, and I hadn't necessarily planned to go down this direction, but I guess I would characterize this fifth force, because I've never thought about it as a fifth force, but I think maybe I would characterize that as the cognitive revolution, because it seems like cognition, which can also embrace mindfulness, that seems to be the big shift.
Yes, yeah, the whole shift in the cognitive behavioral therapies, the dialectical behavioral therapies, Marshall Linehan's work in CBT has embraced mindfulness. So I think we are in the midst of a revolutionary development in a more cognitive approach to dealing with psychological problems. But the piece that I think the cognitive people miss is the body piece. And that's why I think we still have to keep cycling back and reunifying ourselves with the third and the fourth forces of psychology, because the third force, humanistic existential, was really the first force that said, let's not be atomistic and split the mind from the body. Let's be holistic and think about such as a therapy as Gestalt therapy. Let's be holistic.
Yes.
Gestalt means whole. In Sonoma State University, I took my first course with Dr. Larry Horvitz, an old colleague of yours,
right,
in the teaching faculty, and it was in Gestalt therapy.
Yes.
And I remember him saying at his home, that's where he taught the seminar up in Santa Rosa, up in the hills, that if you just focus on the mind, you deal with one pathway. But if you unite the mind with bodily felt experience and bodily felt sensation, then you're opening up third pathway, a third pathway that unifies psyche and soma, soma and psyche.
Yes.
And I think cognitive behavioral needs to kind of circle back a bit and pick up the mind-body connection. And I think mindfulness helps you to do that, because you cannot override or exclude what goes on in your body as well as in your mind when you're practicing mindfulness, because you have to pay attention to everything that comes up, positive, neutral, and negative experience.
Well, that's a good point. And partly you're paying attention to and integrating bodily experience. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes. Yeah, because mindfulness has you pay attention to what you think, what you feel, sensations in the body, pleasurable or painful, what you hear, what you taste, what you smell. And so it's very holistic, and that's why I love it.
Yeah. Now, another place of crossover between cognitive psychology and mindfulness and your writing is attention to destructive and unwholesome beliefs and emotions that come up, and also unwholesome self-judgments. So how does one deal with these, and why are they so universal?
Well, they're universal because I think within us all, there is what Robert Bly refers to in his book, The Little Book of the Shadow, and he really developed his way of thinking from his readings and study of Carl Jung. And I also have studied a fair amount of Jungian psychology, and I know that you have, David.
Yes.
I think you studied or were part of a group with a Mary Merrill. Was that her name?
Yeah, Mary Merrill.
And what I've learned from Jungian psychology, in addition to all of its positive attributes, especially being focused tightly on the spiritual and the archetypal and the transformative and unifying experience is that we've got a shadow. You know, we all have a shadow side. And Robert Bly talks about in his little book of the shadow that the shadow is kind of like a little bag. And what we tend to want to do is most of us tend to want to put all of our destructive, lustful, desirous, angry, rageful, envious experiences secretly. We want to sweep them out of our awareness and put them into this metaphorical bag and kind of stuff it inside of our psyche. And lo and behold, it always comes flying out in one way or the other. And in Buddhist psychology, the emphasis is it's not just on what's called wholesome experience, like, for example, pursuing joy, bliss, states of ecstasy, states of numinosity and oneness. But Buddhist psychology says all experience can be divided between wholesome, positive, neutral experience, and negative, painful, afflictive, or unwholesome experience. And in this continuum, in Buddhist psychology, there's an emphasis that what you want to do is like a gardener who's weeding weeds from his garden or collecting the manure from his cows. You want to till it all into the soil so that next year you're the farmer or the gardener who has the best crop or the greenest grass because you've embraced and you've incorporated your own manure, which is your shadow experiences. You've looked more deeply at your own tendencies to have emotions that, if not mindfully worked with, can cause you a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. Just take, for example, people who struggle, as many people do, with some form of an addiction. And in mindfulness, we teach people how to work with and be mindful and to live through and navigate through those powerful forces of anxiety and desire and greed and hunger that are often the sources or the primary sources of an addiction. And as we embrace what's in our shadow self, we are then far more able to organize the closets of our own internal self-experience and be able to put the shirts where the shirts need to go, metaphorically in terms of feelings, the socks where they need to go, pants where they need to go. We need to, over time, learn to help get the closets in the house of self in a much more organized and contained order.
I like that, the closet with the shirts and the socks. You mentioned addiction. Maybe you could talk a bit about how you use mindfulness meditation in your therapeutic practice, and perhaps a case example or two will come to mind.
Well, I recently was working with a gal who had had two 40-day stints in a drug rehabilitation center outside of Los Angeles in Malibu. And she came into my office, and she was referred by the center. And we sat and we talked about her long history of abuse, childhood sexual abuse and violence, her long history of neglect from both her, primarily from her mother. She had a very loving father. And she had a very long history of having been abused and used by famous and powerful men, which led over time to many heartbreaks and led over time to the cultivation of a series of different addictions. And as we were talking and I was gathering all of this information, I closed my eyes for a couple of minutes and I just went inside, which is something I oftentimes do. And I said, I asked my intuition, what would be most helpful to put this being on a better path? What would really help to assist her and to give her some skills rather than just talking about the addiction? What could I give her that she could take home and she could start to practice and apply? And so I told her, I'd like to teach her mindfulness meditation, and I did, and I suggested that she practice it 3 times a day. And at first, she kind of looked at me in total abject horror.
Yeah.
She said, "You don't understand. When I'm free of drugs and alcohol, my mind is so active, and I have so many painful feelings in my body, I can't even sit still, let alone sit and close my eyes, and you want me to do it 3 times a day? And so I said, yeah, let's do it 3 times a day, but as I said earlier in the interview, let's start out at 5 minutes and build up to 20. And over the course of the next couple of months, she actually put this into place, and she said she had as major a breakthrough as she had had at the rehabilitation center when she had discovered, as most people who are going through 12-step recovery have, which is the experience of the higher power, and what's called the first step. She said it was almost as if she had a first step to the second level, where there was an experience where she said, I could really now understand what many of the older people in the program are talking about when they say, you really have to surrender to the higher power. You have to surrender to an acceptance that this addiction is greater and far more powerful than yourself. And she said, I was able to actually get a firsthand glimpse into that experience of surrender from the mindfulness meditation. She said, I actually experienced my small self, or my egoic mind that's totally wrapped up in my sense of self and my self-image and all of my destructive emotions that feed into that. And I was actually able to separate from it in the mindfulness meditation, and I was able to sit. And I think I sat, I think she said like for an hour and a half for the first time in her life. She said, I was just sitting, and I wasn't trying to be anybody, and I wasn't trying to get away from my pain. I wasn't trying to transform my pain. As a matter of fact, I experienced right before my awareness in my eyes, it was as if the pain in myself had drained out of my body, gone down into the feet, and Mother Earth was absorbing it, and I felt free for the very first time in 40 years.
Wow, that's a great story. And mindfulness got used in 2 different ways. I wasn't expecting it, but the first way it got used was when you tapped into yourself and kind of went into your still place and asked for your intuition to suggest to you the right approach. And of course, and then the second one, of course, was giving her the assignment to get involved with it herself.
Right. And so one of the things that I teach for therapists and mental health professionals is I teach a segment of a course called Transforming the Self, and it's called How to Become the Mindful Clinician. And I think it's really important. And I discovered naturally that after all these years of sitting and meditating, that I feel a great sense of freedom both to be artistically creative when I'm sitting with my patients, but simultaneously to drop into the deeper intuitive wisdom inside of myself by going into a mini mindfulness meditation when I'm sitting with various patients, and particularly when I'm searching or looking for something that's going to have a more diamond-like tool to help them really transform or turn around the problems that they're suffering with. I have another interesting anecdote, and I write about it in the book, but in the book it's written about it a little differently, but a woman once came to me, and she came to my home office up in Topanga Canyon, which is a tiny little village enclave of yuppies, holistic doctors, musicians, artists, poets, and it's a place where I live. And she came to my home office and sat down, and she was extremely well-dressed and finely appointed, and she was working for a Fortune 500 company out of Manhattan, and they had an office in Los Angeles. And the presenting problem was that she had a family of 4 back in, I'll just make up a state, but let's just say in New Jersey, and she was struggling with having an extramarital affair in the Los Angeles office. And she said she'd been to see a variety of therapists, and that she still felt that she couldn't let go of this, and that it was very odd for her because she said she loved her husband, she loved her children, she loved her family, she loved her job, but it was almost as if something was pulling her apart or pulling her down under. And she said she had seen a variety of therapists, but that she was still feeling stuck. So I just had a natural, intuitive feeling to say, let's close our eyes and just sit quietly and go into mindfulness for 10 minutes. And we did. And about 5 or 6 minutes into the meditation, I was seeing in my mind's eye, I was seeing the image of a boat. And the boat was her and a friend, and it was headed out onto a lake. And it was sunny out, and it was beautiful, cloud-free day. And then about a minute later, I saw the boat, and there was this huge storm, and the boat was turned upside down, and there was all this screaming. So I held and contained that, and then at the end of the session, I said, would you like to share with me what you experienced, and then would you like to hear what I experienced? So she shared with me what she experienced, which was a lot of obsessively going over and ruminating, should she stay in the marriage, should she leave the marriage? And I said, would you like to hear what I experienced? And so then I shared her what my internal visualization was. And like a ripe peach, her chest just opened up, she burst out crying, and for about 45 minutes, uncontrollably, she was just sobbing. And she was in that kind of inaudible state where, as a therapist, you can't really tell, you know, something very deep and profound is going on, but you can't quite tell what they're saying because it's so regressed. And then when that quieted and calmed down, I asked her, what were you experiencing? It seems so profound. And she said, what you saw, I have never spoken about in my entire life. When I was 15, my girlfriend and I, we went out in this boat, and out of nowhere, this huge storm came up about an hour later, and the boat was capsized, and my girlfriend drowned. And I was able to swim back to shore, and when the lifeguards came and the police came, they discovered her body, and I was taken to the police station, and my parents picked me up, and then when I was taken home, my father said, you will never discuss this with anyone ever, ever again. And so when she went to school, the teachers had been instructed also to have all of her friends and classmates, no one ever discussed this. For her entire life, she had forgotten about it. She had repressed it as a repressed memory. And it came up in the session. So there's an example of if a therapist will allow themselves to mindfully, metaphorically mine down into their own unconscious experience and to listen to their own intuitive mind, it can be extremely helpful and useful in facilitating someone else's process.
What a marvelous story. I really felt very moved by it as you were telling it. Are there cases or situations where you feel mindfulness meditation would be contraindicated?
Yes, and I'm really glad that you brought that up. For a variety of reasons. Back in the late 70s, I was practicing at the Center for Health and Healing, which was at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Office Tower. It was a center, holistic center that I founded. And I was studying as a student mindfulness meditation with the renowned Buddhist American teacher, Jack Kornfield. And from time to time, he would refer me from retreats out in Joshua Tree, different students who were members of the Zen Center or various Buddhist sanghas in Los Angeles. And this young woman came to me, and she was crying, and she was in tremendous despair. And she said, the more that I practice and the more sesshins that I do, a sesshin is a long-term Zen retreat. It's kind of like the Zen Army Rangers version of boot camp. It's quite an ordeal to sit to a sesshin. And she said, everyone seems to be progressing, but I seem to be getting more depressed, more frustrated, more enraged, and feel really badly about myself as a result of practicing the meditation. So I suggested to her, and this was long before the development of the design of medications like Prozac, I said to her, well, why don't you try something that has to do with walking meditation or riding your bike meditation or playing tennis meditation, something that actively gets you out of your head and into your body and creates more endorphins, creates a greater sense of vitality. And then, again, just trusting my intuition, I said to her, you know, if the cosmos created chamomile tea, maybe someday it's going to create a medication or a series of medications that are going to be ones that make people feel good rather than the old school psychiatric medications that, like the AMO inhibitors and the old school antidepressants. I just had a feeling that, geez, you know, maybe something's going to come along in a few years or 10 years, and it might completely alter and change how you go about meditation. And lo and behold, over the course of the years, she'd come in, we would do therapy. I would discourage her from practicing Zen as it's traditionally practiced and had to do what I would call more meditation in action. And around 1989 or 1990, Prozac came on the market. And my colleague, the esteemed colleague, Mark Epstein, he's a practicing Buddhist psychiatrist, wrote Thoughts Without a Thinker and Falling to Pieces Without Going Apart. He wrote an article in Tricycle magazine that's called Awakening to Prozac. I'm sorry, Awakening Through Prozac. And I gave her the article and gave her a referral, and she went on Prozac. And then she began to go back and to start attending sessions and long-term meditation retreats. In the last 20 years since then, she comes occasionally in to see me, and she tells me now she can actually meditate. Now she can feel what other people are feeling because her brain chemistry is balanced. So this is a long way around the bend of saying, for some people, internal meditation is contraindicated. The whole idea of closing your eyes, let's say, for example, you don't have stabilized brain chemistry, or you've come from a family where you've experienced a great deal of abuse, whether it was physical, sexual, mental, emotional, or spiritual, and you have post-traumatic stress disorder. One thing that we know from dissociative disorders is that when you close your eyes, instead of seeing the white light, you oftentimes go into bad memories, and or you go into what are called trauma pockets. And trauma pockets are, if you would think of, if you're walking down the road and all of a sudden you fall in a hole metaphorically, that's a trauma pocket. And people who have post-traumatic stress disorder pretty much throughout the day are going in and out of their own trauma pockets. So I always suggest don't practice internalized meditation. Practice a form of meditation where you open your eyes, like Zen, or where you Dzogchen, which is an advanced form of Tibetan Buddhism, where you open your eyes and you look out at the blueness of the sky, the vastness of what we call big sky mind. Or you go and you sit in the forest and you look at the trees. So that meditations that take you out of the self rather than inside of the self. For example, people with depressive disorders who fit in the category of minor depressive disorders can gain great benefits with practicing mindfulness meditation. But people who are undergoing a major depressive disorder and have any kind of suicidal ideation or harmful thoughts of hurting themselves, it's contraindicated. I think it's better to get them out and active and doing meditation in action rather than having them sit and go inward.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense to me, and I'm glad I asked you about that. Well, we've been going on for a while here, so I think we probably should begin to wind down. I'm wondering if there's anything else that you'd like to say before we close.
Well, I would just like to suggest to all of the listeners to experiment with what method of meditation works for them, whether it's an inward one or an outward one or a combination of the two, because certainly There doesn't have to be any kind of rigidity. And to if they get a chance to pick up the book, Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis, Loss and Change by Ronald Alexander, PhD. And if you'd like further information, you can always go on my website, which is openmindtraininginstitute.com or ronaldalexander.com. And this has been terrific, David. I'm very pleased and blessed that you had me on the show again.
Well, my good friend, Ron Alexander, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with my friend, Dr. Ron Alexander. By way of commentary, I thought I'd share with you some highlights from a written review of his book that I recently did. Remember, the title of the book is Wise Mind, Open Mind, Finding Purpose and Meaning in Times of Crisis, Loss, and Change. And in part I write, in so many ways, this is the right book at the right time. Certainly, we are in a time of crisis, loss, and change, both nationally and globally. And for many, this also translates into personally. And the promise of finding meaning in this time of chaos and rapid change is especially compelling. Beyond this, Dr. Alexander's focus on mindfulness, a central theme of this book, could not be more timely. There's been a gathering wave of interest in mindfulness, not just as a meditative practice, but also as a focus of brain research and therapeutic application. Dr. Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin comes to mind for his fMRI imaging of the brains of mindfulness meditators, as does Dr. Philippe Golden at Stanford. On the therapeutic front, we have Dr. Alan Marlatt at the University of Washington researching mindfulness as an intervention for substance abuse. And of course, Jon Kabat-Zinn, widely recognized as a pioneer for his work on mindfulness as an antidote for stress-related disorders. Mindfulness has even found its way into psychotherapies whose theoretical roots are in such seemingly polar opposition as the cognitive behavioral approach on the one hand and the psychodynamic approach on the other. For example, mindfulness is a central concept in the dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, of Dr. Marsha Linehan, as well as the acceptance and commitment therapy of Dr. Stephen Hayes. Both of these have considerable research validation to back them up. And Dr. Jeffrey Young's schema therapy combines mindfulness with elements drawn from both cognitive behavioral and psychodynamic approaches. There are many other examples that could be cited. Again, I say Wise Mind, Open Mind is the right book at the right time because it so beautifully surfs the surge of academic and therapeutic interest without getting bogged down in technicalities. Dr. Alexander avoids the mystification that so often seems to be inherent in academic and spiritual treatises alike. We may indeed be living in a time of crisis, loss, and change, but we are also living in an exciting time in which the wisdom of the East is increasingly being integrated into Western psychology and psychotherapy. And certainly, Dr. Ronald Alexander should be counted among the pioneers of this rapprochement.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
The podcast awards nominations closed on October 18, and I didn't get my last show out to announce them until October 15. So if any of you managed to nominate Shrink Wrap Radio during that narrow window, I offer hearty thanks. Now, you definitely want to hurry over to my latest interview on my other series at www.wisecounselpodcast.com.
It's with noted psychologist Dr. Paul Ekman. He's particularly famous for having developed a system for coding the fleeting micro-expressions on people's faces. I've been chasing him for years, by the way. In particular, his system is able to detect lying to a very high degree of accuracy and is used by law enforcement agencies around the world. You may have seen the currently popular TV drama, Lie to Me, which is based on his work. He has also had some very interesting and intense meetings with the Dalai Lama, which we also discuss in the interview. A listener has recommended that I interview an Australian dream worker by the name of Jane Teresa Anderson. I was unfamiliar with her work, but went to her website and see that she has been in the media a lot and evidently has a gift for giving very quick and on-point dream interpretations. If you would like to have one of your dreams interpreted when I interview her, please email me your dream. They should probably not be too long or elaborate. I'm hoping that I'll have at least 4 or 5 dreams for her to respond to. So type that dream up that's been puzzling you, and let's see how she does. And speaking of dreams, you might recall my interview with Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster on Archetypal Dreamwork on Shrink Wrap Radio 212, as well as their colleague Roger Kamenetz on Shrink Wrap Radio 219. I want to thank them for helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio by placing a banner ad on our site. They do very deep work, and I encourage you to take advantage of one of their free webinars. I attended one and found it very useful. Just follow the link in the North of Eden ad in our right-hand sidebar. And speaking of dreams, let me remind you to visit our new Shrink Wrap Radio store. There's a new tab at the top of our homepage. It's for the Shrink Wrap Radio store. And right now, there are 2 things in our store. First, I've moved the T-shirt ad there, so it's easier to find. And you could get your own T-shirt with Shrink Wrap Radio logo on it. And I make no money on the T-shirts, but would love to have you out there wearing it. And the really new thing in the store that I'm very excited about, but nobody has taken advantage of yet, is I've created a CD of 30 interviews related to dreams, and depth psychology. You can see the whole list of interviewees on the site, but I can tell you that it includes such notables as Michael Mead, Robert Moss, Charles Tart, Stanley Krippner, Jeremy Taylor, Alan Siegel, Dana Houck, John Beebe, and many more. And you could download all these from the site, but it would take you hours to do so. Plus, these are just the interviews and my commentary. No ads, no announcements, no listener emails. So this would make a wonderful gift for the upcoming holiday season. The cost is only $20 plus shipping. That's less than $1 an interview. And your CD comes in a beautiful DVD-style case, which will fit nicely on a bookshelf. And you can purchase it using PayPal or a credit card, and you don't have to be a member of PayPal to do it. So I hope you'll take advantage of this offer. And let me remind you to join our Yahoo discussion group. There's a banner link on our website in the right-hand sidebar, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Please contact me if you'd be interested in being a volunteer transcriber. We have a lot of transcripts that were done, but it's all fallen off for some reason, and we could use your help if you're at all interested. And thanks to all of you who have made financial donations. We got several this month, and I especially appreciate the people who have renewed their year-long pledges. I guess we've been doing it for about a year now, a little bit over, and that does provide important, predictable base, which I greatly appreciate. So if you haven't done so yet, please go to Shrink Wrap Radio and click on that big green donate button. And of course, I also appreciate your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds, Brookstone, Budget Car Rentals, Angie's List, and Avis. And now please stay tuned for a brief public service announcement.
Hi, I'm Mark Pelsey from Futures in Biotech.
I'm Vincent Racaniello from This Week in Virology.
So Vincent, as a virologist, what are your thoughts about the H1N1 vaccine?
Well, Mark, I think we should all go out and get it, but I'm afraid that a lot of people are scared.
Scared of what? What happens to you when you get the vaccine?
Well, it's injected in your arm, you get a little redness and fever for a day, and then you're fine.
So it's safe and it works?
It's absolutely safe and it protects you against influenza.
So let's do this together. Let's consult our doctors about getting the H1N1 vaccine. Thanks, Vincent.
You bet, Mark.
I'm running a bit long here, so I'm just going to read two emails, and as it happens, they're both from the same person. The first reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I very much enjoyed your podcast and have recommended it to many people. My mom is now an avid fan. I listen to lots of podcasts, and yours is my favorite." Yay, glad to hear that. "I do have a question for you. For the last month or so, I've been doing and really enjoying the work of Byron Katie. I sit down and work on a stressful thought almost every day. This has really helped in decreasing the stress I experience in my daily life. However, I have also started having very bad nightmares. For example, last night, I dreamed that my two little brothers were each shot in the head within a month of each other, and I spent most of the dream mourning, crying, and screaming. I'm finding that in a lot of these dreams, I spend a lot of time screaming at the top of my lungs, which is not something I do in my everyday life. I've always been a very lucid dreamer and have always been able to remember my dreams very vividly. Often they seem very real to me even after waking up. However, in the past, they were more often than not very pleasant. The odd thing is that on the surface, things in my life seem very calm right now, and with doing the work, I feel like my mental health is much better than it's ever been. Could it be that by doing the work and bringing my fears and stresses out into the open, that it brings things up in my dreams that I've not dealt with yet? What would you suggest that I do? Any books you recommend on dealing with dreams? Would it be a good idea to go into therapy and see what else I can figure out? How do you recommend I go about finding a good therapist? Anyone you recommend? Best, Rachel." I believe I got back to Rachel suggesting that she tried journaling about her dream, dialoguing with the dream, and particularly asking herself what in her life she would like to scream about. And she wrote back a week or two later saying, "Just wanted to drop a quick note of thanks for your advice. I did journal about the screaming dreams. I came up with some very interesting things that I would love to share when I have more time to type them out. What was interesting was that the very night after I did the journaling you suggested back on the 11th, I didn't have a frightening, screaming nightmare for the first time in about a month. It seems that in part the dreams may have been literally screaming at me to pay attention to them. I haven't had a nightmare since, although now since listening to some of your podcasts about dreams, I'm more open to the idea of nightmares if they come back, as now I understand that they can have important information for me. But for now, I'm back to pleasant dreaming. Yay! I also took your advice and am going back and listening to your other podcasts about dreaming. Thanks for making this information available. I just listened to number 199, The Secret History of Dreaming with Robert Moss, and I have to say, wow, what fascinating information. I've always been able to remember my dreams after waking, and although I've told lots of people about my dreams, no one has ever mentioned to me that there could be some meaning to them. I've even had some very unique experiences with dreams that seem to be predictive of future events, to hold important messages, etc., but I've shied away from sharing these experiences with anyone for fear of being seen as, quotes, crazy. In fact, I didn't even want to believe in these experiences myself because I thought maybe I really was being a little nutty. So your podcasts, and especially those about dreaming, are really opening up a whole new world to me. Thanks again, and I will keep you updated." And that's from Rachel. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send me your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod, or you can leave voice messages on my phone. I'd love to hear from you. I haven't gotten any voice messages in a long time. It's 206-337-0622. Thanks again to my guest, Dr. Ronald Alexander, for sharing his insights on mindfulness meditation and about his book, Wise Mind, Open Mind. My next show will feature Dr. Robert Cull, who went off to the wilds of Patagonia and lived in complete solitude for a year in his own personal quest for wisdom. It's a fascinating and courageous story. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.